Tehran slams as irresponsible the remarks by the European Union officials about its role in the attack on an Israeli-owned tanker. Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai has explained why he rejected a U.S. proposal of bilateral security agreement while he was in office. And France extending its controversial COVID health pass system to more routine activities despite nationwide protests. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Starting with some reaction by Iran that's slamming the remarks made by the EU officials on a recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible.
The remarks by the British Foreign Secretary against the Iranian nation are nothing new, and they are only a sample of the many irresponsible remarks that have been made in the past years by British officials. I seriously recommend the UK government to pay attention to its duties and responsibilities, and they should know that the security of the Persian Gulf is a red line for Iran.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh rejected the allegations as baseless, saying that blaming Iran is a scenario planned by the Israeli regime. He said the comments of the EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region. He noted that Tehran is committed to ensuring the security of the strategic Persian Gulf waterway and the Strait of Hormuz. The reaction came after the G7 foreign ministers and EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell claimed that Iran was involved in last week's attack on an Israeli-managed vessel off the coast of Oman. Tel Aviv saying it's ready to strike Iran in retaliation, Iran already warning of a crushing response to any such move. Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai has explained why he rejected a U.S. proposal of bilateral security agreement while he was in office.
I refused because I was clear in my mind with evidence that without first having peace in Afghanistan, without guaranteeing peace in Afghanistan, without guaranteeing a dignified relationship with Pakistan based on the interest of both countries, and without making sure that the BSA will certainly be effective for peace in Afghanistan, signing that agreement would be detrimental to Afghan peace, that the foreign forces would be staying safely in their bases and Afghans would be dying. And unfortunately, that's what happened. So I'm glad I didn't sign that, and I was very determined not to sign.
Karzai said that the U.S. military activities in Afghanistan in the name of fighting the Taliban caused immense suffering to Afghan civilians, including women and children. He said that civilian homes and families were bombed and destroyed for no reason. The former president said he gave his full back into the U.S. initiative for peace in order to end the war on his country, but he said such a process did not give the desired results. It rather caused more sufferings. Karzai also defended calling the Taliban brothers, despite the group never welcoming his peace proposal.
I did call them brothers, and for two reasons. One reason was that they belonged to our country. They were our countrymen, and countrymen are brothers. The other reason was that the U.S. Military activity in Afghanistan, in the name of fighting the Taliban, was causing immense suffering to the Afghan civilians and Afghan people.
Karzai, however, urged the Taliban to end attacking villages and towns that belong to their own countrymen. He warned that such attacks serve the interests of foreign powers and could lead to internal uprising against the militant group. The former president called on global and regional powers, including Russia, China, Iran, and Pakistan, to join hands with the Afghan people to bring lasting peace to the country. Meantime, the spokesman for the Taliban saying that there is no agreement on a ceasefire with the Kabul government. The Taliban's political office also warned against further U.S. intervention in the country. The militants, meantime, have captured another provincial capital as government forces are trying to halt the group's rapid advances across the country. The militants have reportedly seized the city of Talokan, the capital of Takhar province. That's the fifth provincial capital the Taliban have seized in 2 days. Early on Sunday, they took over the cities of Sarapol and Kunduz, officials saying that heavy fighting still rages in Kunduz. Kabul correspondent Amin Alami says that Afghan troops have pushed back the Taliban in the capital of Badakhshan province.
The capital of Badakhshan, Faizabad, is also currently the scene of fighting between Afghan troops and Taliban militants. Afghan military commanders in Faizabad, the capital of northeastern Badakhshan province, say that Afghan troops have pushed back Taliban attack from inside the city, and currently some fightings are underway between government troops backed by local armed forces and the Taliban in the outskirts of the city. Taliban has paid a special attention to Badakhshan because it connects Afghanistan with Tajikistan, with China, and with Pakistan.
August 8th marks the 23rd anniversary of the killing of Iranian diplomats and a news correspondent in the Afghan city of Mazar-e-Sharif. They were killed in an attack on the Iranian consulate in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. At the time, Mazar-e-Sharif was embroiled in a battle between the Taliban and Northern Alliance. The Taliban denied responsibility and blamed the consulate attack on renegade forces.
In a statement released on Saturday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry commemorated the Iranian diplomats and a journalist who were killed at the Consulate General of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Mazar-e-Sharif, Afghanistan, in August 1998. The Iranian Foreign Ministry condemned the terrorist attack, saying it was against all international laws and treaties. The body also announced that different aspects of the attack are required to be clarified, and this is a definite demand of the government and people of Iran. 23 years ago, the Taliban captured Mazar-e-Sharif. After that, the group admitted that 10 Iranian diplomats and a journalist had been killed during an attack on the Iranian consulate. The Taliban spokesman said the Iranians had been killed by renegade forces who had acted without orders. Furthermore, the ministry reiterated its call on all parties to the war in Afghanistan to end the conflict and seek a solution in the negotiations. That's why the UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan has warned that the country is heading toward a, quote, catastrophe.
In the past weeks, the war in Afghanistan has entered a new, deadlier, and more destructive phase. The Taliban campaign during June and July to capture rural areas has achieved significant territorial gains. From this strengthened position, they have begun to attack the larger cities.
The Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks across Afghanistan since May, seizing large swaths of rural and urban areas, including some key border crossings. They are now focused on capturing provincial capitals. The Taliban has also vowed to ramp up assaults against top government officials.
U.S. President Joe Biden has reportedly ordered American Air Force to carry out air raids against the Taliban as the militant group continues to advance toward major African cities. It's reported the Taliban have suffered heavy casualties. The question remains how the Taliban can believe it can control and manage the country, given the developments on the ground.
The U.S. B-52 bombers and Spectre gunships have reportedly targeted Taliban positions in northern Afghanistan. While there has been no confirmation of the airstrikes or possible damage by Taliban militants, Afghan Defense Ministry has declared that the airstrikes inflicted significant damage to the militants. The deployment of American bombers and gunships further highlights the degree of dependency of Afghan forces on U.S. military support. Also, the development has further raised questions about the reliability of persistent claims made over the years by the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, that they have primarily been engaged in training Afghan government forces to independently safeguard the country's security against various threats. Meanwhile, the airstrikes came as the militants advanced towards key cities. On Friday, the Taliban captured the capitals of two Afghan provinces in a matter of 24 hours, the city of Shebirghan in Jawzjan and the city of Zarandj in Nimruz.
Of course, the Taliban cannot be expected to provide security to the embassies and diplomats of other countries. And as you mentioned, the incident of the what happened at the Iranian embassy and the killing of Iranian diplomats was a very tragic event. But what more can we expect from Taliban? If you look at Taliban's history, if you look at Taliban's rule in Afghanistan, it's a rule of destruction, of violence and suppression. And I'm afraid we are again heading back into the situation.
Taliban militants have continued their offensives and are taking over all Afghanistan. Also, more than 1,000 Afghan civilians have been killed in the past month. This clearly contradicts the group's claims about being committed to a peace process or a political settlement. In fact, further bloodshed will only complicate the reconciliation process.
In other news, France extending its controversial COVID health pass system to more routine activities despite nationwide protests. The measure requires people to show a health pass to enter cafes, restaurants, and shopping malls. They'll also need a pass for traveling on intercity trains. The system shows one has been fully vaccinated against the coronavirus, has tested negative, or recently recovered. It's already been required since July 21st to visit cultural venues in France. The extension was approved on Thursday despite weeks of protests, which called the rule against civil liberties. Authorities are saying the scheme is necessary to stop the spread of the coronavirus. France has recorded more than 6.2 million cases. Kristen Holmes says that the French government is increasing restrictive measures to encourage vaccination due to the low numbers of fully vaccinated people.
The French government has taken more restrictive measures because only 50% of the French population has been vaccinated twice, and that's not enough to hold back the virus and especially the Delta variant. So if people would be convinced by the medical facts that they should be vaccinated in order to prevent a new lockdown and a new curfew, there would be no health pass necessary. But the French government, and it has been approved by the Senate and by the Parliament and by the Constitutional Council, consider that in order to obtain 60-70% of the population vaccinated twice, they need to push them a little bit. So they ordered this health pass, and people, if they go to restaurants and to smaller places, not big places, smaller places, even there they have to show that electronic document to prove that they are vaccinated or a negative PCR test.
South Korea begins opening COVID-19 vaccine reservations for all adults over the age of 18. It's struggling to contain cluster outbreaks. Inoculation for this major age bracket is set to begin on August 26. It's expected to run until the end of September. The government is planning to immunize over 70% of the population by the end of September. That's the adult population. Some 45% of the country's population has received at least the first dose. Around 15% of South Korea's 52 million population has been fully vaccinated. The sluggish vaccination drive has overlapped with the surge of more transmissible viral strains.
The South Korean government extended its highest level of social distancing for two more weeks as new cases of COVID-19 drag on at over 1,500 per day, the most since the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020.
The speed of the ongoing outbreak is slowing, but the size of the outbreak is still big, and this shows it's unclear if the outbreak will display a downward trajectory soon. The movement of people is not decreasing as much as desired, and the Delta variant cases continue to increase.
The more contagious Delta variant of the virus is responsible for more than half of the new cases. Private gatherings of more than two people after 6 p.m. are banned, and nightlife is largely shut down. The South Korean government had just announced the relaxation of social distancing guidelines when the fourth wave struck here in early July, forcing officials to reverse course. And pressure now is mounting for relief. Churches have been critical over restrictions on the number of people that can attend services, and unions have held large street rallies challenging the guidelines. Although most people observe government advisories, frustration is growing.
The level of social distancing has been increased and decreased and increased again. Personally, I think that social distancing has no point because it's nonsense. We are now in level 4 of social distancing, but the number of new cases has not decreased.
Officials say measures will be relaxed when case numbers fall. South Korea has so far vaccinated about 15% of the population, with the government now considering booster shots for those most vulnerable. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Japan's Nagasaki is marking the 76th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of the city, 3 days after the same attack on Hiroshima. During the event, the Nagasaki mayor urged the government to sign a UN treaty on creating a nuclear weapon-free zone in Northeast Asia. Other countries have signed a treaty that came into effect in January. On August 9, 1945, the U.S. dropped an A-bomb on the city. An estimated 74,000 people were killed. Most of the city got destroyed in that attack. On August 6, the U.S. conducted another attack with an atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima. That attack also killed tens of thousands of people. The Yemeni army and allied Ansarullah fighters have made fresh gains in the central province of Al-Baida, liberating two more districts from Saudi-backed militants. Spokesman of the Yemeni armed forces says the two districts were captured during an operation to liberate the entire province. Yahya Sari said the forces are in the process of clearing out the remaining pockets in Baida. The Yemeni army launched an operation dubbed Nasr al-Mubin last week. It has continued advancing since then. It's also inching closer to Bayhan town in Shabwa province. That's strategically near the border with Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed militants in northern Yemen. Scores of Daesh and al-Qaeda-linked terrorists have been killed in the operation. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. A televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. The kind of Islam that Imam wanted. From the viewpoint of Imam, Islam is a system that seeks justice, and that it is opposed to arrogance and corruption. These are clear in the statements of Imam. These statements can be found both in his testament and in the 20-plus volumes on Imam's statements, both of which have been published. Of course, we ourselves heard these viewpoints directly from Imam, but those who were not born then and who did not see Imam could refer to his statements. The context of Imam's statements is clear. The kind of Islam that Imam believes in is anti-arrogance, that is, anti-American. It is against the domination and interference of foreigners and foreign powers, interference in the domestic affairs of the country. It is against kneeling before the enemy. It is an anti-corruption Islam. The kind of Islam that Imam believes in is anti-corruption and is opposed to giving privileges to certain individuals. The things that are revealed in the area of corruption in some sectors today are definitely the opposite of what Islam wants. Islam is a religion that fights against corruption. An Islamic government is a government that combats corruption. Such a government is also anti-reactionary. Reactionary meaning contaminating life with old regressive thoughts and drifting away from new Islamic thoughts, those of our magnanimous Imam. Islam is hostile to aristocracy and advocates the underprivileged. Islam does not favor class inequalities, the gap between the poor and the rich. Late in his blessed life, a few months before his demise, Imam writes a letter to an official saying, "You should show that our people rose up against oppression, chaos, reactionary attitude and retro-regressive ideas, and that they replaced a monarchic, capitalist, eclectic, and in some, an American Islam with an original Islam introduced by Muhammad."
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at open areas around the Israeli-occupied Sheba farms. In a statement, Hezbollah said it hit open fields near Israeli positions at 11:15 a.m. local time Friday using dozens of 122 caliber rockets. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television said at least 20 rockets were fired at Israel's military positions. Al-Minar TV said a number of the rockets targeted the Duf military base. A Lebanese security source said the rockets were launched from the area of Al-Arkoub near the Lebanese town of Sheba. Air raid sirens sounded in the Upper Galilee and in the Golan Heights, part of the territory Israel occupied in 1967. Israeli media said residents of settlements in the north of the occupied territories had been asked to stay in homes. The development came after Israeli jets struck what the regime's military claimed were sites where rockets had been launched earlier in the week.
Bombing Syria, bombing Lebanon is a way of their practice, a way of dividing new states and new communities to get legitimization for their sick political Zionist project. They try everything. They try everything to forbid building a civil state because this is their real threat to their ideology. Defending our land should not be alone through weapons and fighting, but with completing this with a political project which should be contradicted to the Sikh ideology of Zionism.
Regional resistance movements, including Palestinian Hamas and Yemeni Ansarullah, hailed their retaliatory attacks as a legitimate right against Israeli aggressions. Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabi Berri, said in a statement that the attacks on his country reflected the true nature of Israel. He added that the regime only understands the language of, quote, unity and resistance. President Michel Aoun also denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and the stability of the region. Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem also said the resistance movement is committed to the principle that any aggression on Lebanon will be met with a proper response, and for this reason it responded to the aggressive enemy with rockets. He, however, downplayed the possibility that the situation would escalate to a full-blown war.
Fragmentation of this society, or of our societies, is no less dangerous than the threat of the Zionist project. Managing its affairs, maintaining its cohesion in light of what we are experiencing, is not separated from fighting the Zionist project, but it is the core of confronting it.
Israel's attacks on Lebanon's south followed the regime's similar airstrikes on Syria in recent months. The regime has recently threatened to take military action against Iran after accusing the Islamic Republic of being involved in a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman, an allegation that Tehran has denied. The Islamic Republic has called on the United Nations Security Council to confront Israel's adventurism and reject its fabrications. Tehran says Israel is trying to distract the public attention away from the regime's crimes in the region, warning that any miscalculation on the Israeli side will be met with an immediate and crushing response.
Ibrahim Raisi is now officially the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran after his mandate was endorsed by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, at a ceremony in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei's decree endorsed the presidential mandate of Raisi. The text was read out at the event by head of the leader's office. The ceremony took place at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in Tehran in full compliance with COVID safety protocols and was attended by the country's senior state and military officials. Raisi said, through their participation in the election, the Iranian people sent a message that they are demanding change, justice, as well as a fight against corruption, poverty, and discrimination. For his part, Ayatollah Khamenei called for a swift formation of the administration and said the country's conditions do not warrant a delay in the process. Raisi is the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He won almost 62% of the votes in the June 18th presidential election and will succeed President Hassan Rouhani, who served 2 4-year terms in office. Raisi will take an oath of office in an inauguration ceremony at the Iranian parliament, or Majlis, on Thursday. But his new government is set to face a series of challenges. First and foremost, Iran's economy needs urgent action and medium-term planning to grow. Cruel and illegal US sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic have severely hampered Iran's economic growth. Iran is also dealing with an unprecedented drought, which has negatively affected its energy production and its agriculture sector in certain parts of the country.
So Iran has survived the American sanctions. I think they can continue as long as they use imaginative ways of implementing the exchange of goods and services by different currencies or barter.
Raisi has pledged to prioritize Iran's domestic needs and combat poverty, unemployment, inflation, and corruption. But in order to achieve that end, a certain give and take on regional issues is necessary, and Iran can prosper by playing an even greater stability role commensurate with the country's pivotal position.
Well, in my view, I think President Raisi won't necessarily remove the sanctions, but what he will do is increase Iran's ability to circumvent them. It's possible, for example, to use other currencies than the United States dollar to pay for trading back and forth.
Raisi has vowed not to repeat his predecessor's mistake of putting nearly all the bets on the nuclear deal and the resolution of foreign-imposed sanctions. He said he will decouple his agenda from the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi has called on the U.S. to live up to its nuclear deal obligations.
I think President Raisi is talking more about countries such as Iraq and Syria and Libya and Lebanon and neighboring countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. I think that relying on Saudi Arabia and Israel and the Gulf states is a non-starter.
Raisi has said time and again that his government will solidify the relationship between Iran and regional countries. He's described strong ties with Iran's neighbors as important for the economy.
A somber mood prevails in Japan as the nation marks the 76th anniversary of the United States nuclear attack on the city of Hiroshima. The horrific atomic bombing was carried out during the final stages of World War II in 1945. On August 6th that year, an estimated 140,000 people were incinerated immediately under a mushroom cloud or died in the following months. Meanwhile, Japan is preparing to honor the victims of America's second nuclear strike. The bombing of the city of Nagasaki a few days later left tens of thousands of others dead. Many decades have passed since the world experienced the horrors and pain of nuclear attacks. The world doesn't truly seem to have learned a lesson from the catastrophes. Atomic weapons still pose an existential threat to humankind. There have been international calls for the total annihilation of nuclear arms worldwide. But atomic arsenals are not being dismantled or even reduced in number. They are instead being expanded and upgraded regardless of the incredible dangers and costs. The United States, which is the only country to have used nukes against another nation, is ironically leading the race to develop new nuclear weapons and modernize existing ones. The U.S. has openly accelerated the costly modernization of the American arsenal. Figures show that in recent years, America has spent heavily on its nuclear weapons program, almost as much as all other spenders like China, Britain, and Russia combined. The costs of such modernization programs run into the tens of billions of dollars each year.
I know in the United States there are very strong lobby groups that are representing the weapons industry, groups that represent companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Honeywell. These are some of the large producers of nuclear weapons. And they lobby Congress to pass more money. And what we saw is it really doesn't matter who is in the White House.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on governments to make the goal of a nuclear weapons-free world a reality. The UN chief warned that the push by nuclear weapons states to modernize their atomic arsenals has sparked a new arms race.
The U.S. now says that it needs to modernize these nuclear weapons because it's facing the adversary of China. But this is ridiculous because China has very few nuclear weapons and a much smaller military than the United States in all aspects. And it's not a time to be fueling a new race for nuclear weapons. it's a time to be recognizing that the world needs to conserve its resources to put into things like healthcare, getting rid of COVID, those kind of things, the climate issue.
The situation has undermined global security, but nuclear armed states are reluctant to even discuss disarmament. It is ironic that most of the big spenders on atomic arms are permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. They are definitely not making the world a safer place by spending more and more on such weapons of mass destruction. The United States and Russia have over 90% of all nukes worldwide, with over 14,000 warheads. America has the biggest number of deployed warheads, with hundreds of them ready to be used. India, Pakistan, and North Korea also possess nuclear weapons, but have not joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Meanwhile, Israel, which developed nuclear weapons in the 1960s with Western assistance, is the only possessor of nukes in West Asia. Israel and its supporters have blocked all efforts meant to create a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. Possessors of these weapons have defied international calls to disarm. Observers believe they are responsible for the persistent threat of nuclear war.
On Thursday, an Israeli-managed oil tanker came under attack off the coast of Oman. The Liberian-flagged and Japanese-owned vessel, dubbed Mercer Street, was reportedly on its way from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, to Fujairah in the United Arab Emirates when it was targeted. In a statement on Friday, Zodiac Maritime, the Israeli-owned firm managing the oil tanker, said that two crewmen, a Briton and a Romanian, had been killed in the assault. In recent months, several other Israeli-managed ships have come under attack on various maritime routes across the world. Israel was quick to accuse Iran of carrying out the attack, pushing for a United Nations action against Tehran. This is while Iran has denied any involvement in the attack. But that's ironic, as the regime has had more UN resolutions imposed against it than the rest of the world combined.
You know, hypocrisy in the international scene is nothing new, and we are all familiar with that. That's one point of view. Make some alliance against Iran to make it politicize actually the situation and take it to the Security Council of the United Nations to put more pressure on Iran to force the next administration to go to the negotiation table over the nuclear issue, and they hope for further talks on regional issues or missile programs and such things, but it doesn't seem to work like that actually.
The United States and the United Kingdom have joined Israel in hurling the accusation at Iran without providing any corroborative evidence. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that Washington is confident that Iran conducted the attack on the empty Mercer Street and vowed, quote, an appropriate response. Blinken has also stated that there will be a collective response against Iran. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab also said UK assessments had concluded that it was highly likely that Iran used one or more drones to carry out the deadly attack.
Forcing their ally in the region, which is actually a regime created, actually manufactured by them in the many decades ago. So it is natural that they would support that, and they want to put pressure on Iran. We know that we are in a time of transition of power in Iran. President Raisi is going to actually take office in upcoming days. And this time is a time that they think that there can be some, let's say, uncertainty in the government and power in Iran. So they're trying to put pressure on the next administration, actually.
The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, however, has warned against any possible act of adventurism against country's interests, pledging an immediate, powerful, and serious response to any such move. A source close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that threats issued by Western officials and Israel are considered more of a propaganda gesture. The source, however, vowed any move against Iran's interests and national security will be met with Tehran's, quote,
crushing and firm response, and Washington and London will be directly responsible for the consequences. There are also unconfirmed reports that Israel has gotten the green light from the U.S. to go ahead with an attack that may involve targeting an Iranian port or vessel.
It is time of transition of power in Iran, but the Westerners think that this time of transition is affecting the military power and will of Iran. But the military and the armed forces are not under the president in Iran. And so that by the change of the administration, the policies, or the actually vigilance of the armed forces would change.
If the report is true, it goes to show that London and Washington have given Israel carte blanche to commit crimes with impunity. But as Iranian officials have stressed, any possible aggression won't go unanswered.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr-i Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini, on some of the secrets of recitation. The recitation of the holy men, four that there are in brief, three stages. First, the translation, stage of the agent manifestation upon the guardianship. Second, the manifestation of the nominal translation. And the thirdly, the manifestation of the essential translation. And in these three stages, the wayfarer praises through the divinity tongue, because the example of supererogatory proximity begins from the agent manifestation stage. Thus, the wayfarer praises his worship through the tongue of Allah. The servant becomes the God's tongue, and God becomes the servant tongue. Ali alayhi salam said, Ali is the God's eyes, God's hands, and tongue.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to another episode of Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Ayman Rizvi. Imam Khomeini, peace and blessings on his soul, has said, Islamic revolution of Iran is a reflection of Ashura and the great divine revolution. If we pay attention to the history, we will find out that Ashura has really given power and energy to the revolution of Iran. Both of the imams, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and Imam Khomeini as well, they stood for justness, righteousness, and truth. And what happened after that is that we see in the history that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, for example, in the field of Karbala, paid sacrifices, sacrifice of his own life, sacrifice of his family members, the sacrifice of his dear friends and his disciples. And after his killing, after his martyrdom, you know, his family members, women especially, were taken as a prisoner. So there were trials and tribulations, we see that. And if we pay attention to the revolution of Iran, when Imam Khomeini was struggling, he was giving speeches, he also got arrested. So many of young people were died. So many of innocent people have died. So both places have similarities in this sense as well. They were alone. They stood against corruption. They stood for justice, righteousness, and truth. They paid sacrifices. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. We see that Imam Hussein and his family members were killed in the field of Karbala at that time. You know, apparently they lost. But what happened in the long run? If we pay attention to these 1,400 years till now, the Arba'een, which is the 40th day of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, is the biggest procession ever. So right now we should pay attention to the revolution of Iran. For example, 40 years ago, Imam was alone and he was struggling against corruption. But what happened after 40 years? What happened after 40 years? It's an amazing outcome of progress, righteousness, the truth, and justness. We see that even the Western world is accepting this fact that Imam Khomeini has changed the world.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. This program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. As usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about how Hollywood has used mainstream cinema as a propaganda tool in Afghanistan to justify the US military occupation of the country and to manipulate reality on the devastating war. And we shall take a look at how the propaganda films have been used to glorify invading US-led allied forces and demonize local Afghans, and also to reinforce negative stereotypes of Afghans.
Afghanistan has for long been an operational laboratory for its American occupiers. and the mainstream Hollywood films have been tasked to paint a rosy picture of this military occupation, show invaders as heroes fighting the evil, and humanize the tyrants and demonize the victims. In the process, they have tried to justify the unjustifiable. The propaganda-driven cinema has been effectively used for mass manipulation. Films like The Outpost, Brothers, Lions for Lambs, War Machine, and Lone Survivor provide justification for America's invasion of Afghanistan by creating sympathy for the American occupying forces and spawning hatred for the Afghans.
From Lone Survivor, which depicts Afghans as savage people while painting US soldiers as heroes, The Outpost, that shows Americans as passive victims and Taliban as aggressors, War Machine, that creates fake sympathy for US forces fighting the so-called good war, to United States of Al, a situation comedy that reduces Afghan victims into one-dimensional villains, Western productions have gone a long way to shape perspectives of the US longest war spanning two decades. Most Hollywood productions after the US invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 and the so-called War on Terror propounded by then US President George Bush kept the people of Afghanistan on the periphery while placing the invaders center stage. The idea was to humanize the occupiers and justify their crimes in the name of counterinsurgency. After all, Americans pay to see war films that show their trigger-happy soldiers intimidate, hound, harass, and kill the weak and vulnerable. This gaslighting and criminal manipulation of facts over the years led to people in America think U.S. forces were in Afghanistan at the invitation of Afghans to bring freedom and liberty. But the reality dawns late.
American filmmakers have always been condemned for distortion of historical records. Movies such as Wind Talkers, The Patriot, Rambo, Black Hawk Down, Pearl Harbor, and Jarhead are some of the classic examples of America's propagandist filmmaking. In Afghanistan's context, the failure to decimate the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, which was the stated objective of the invasion, forced Hollywood to attempt damage control at the behest of warmongering politicians in Washington. When military adventures prove counterproductive, cinema comes into play by presenting fiction as reality and serving nefarious political agendas.
Hollywood's portrayal of the landlocked country ensconced in the mighty Hindu Kush Mountains has been far from consistent, reflective of the US political and military somersaults. When the so-called Mujahideen fought the Soviet Army in 1980s, they were hailed as heroes in the US media. On one occasion in 1991, then US President Jimmy Carter's National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was photographed on the front line with Osama bin Laden. A 2007 film, Charlie Wilson's War, starring Tom Hanks, shows US supplying Stinger portable ground-to-air missiles to Afghan fighters. Little did Americans know they would be invading the country many years later to take out their former ally, followed by 20 years of failed war against the tribal fighters who once used to be on the CIA payroll. To think that they could conquer Afghanistan, known as the Graveyard of Empires, where the British were thrown out in the 19th century, the Soviets were forced to beat the hasty retreat in 1980s, was plain naivety. This issue features in Brad Pitt's starrer War Machine, although it also ends up lionizing the invaders. For two decades, as the US military adventurism spawned horrible human rights abuses in Afghanistan, Hollywood tried to cover it up through propaganda, distortion, and misrepresentation.
Interestingly, Hollywood filmmakers, despite their uncanny penchant for war and war-ravaged countries, have shot Afghan war films mostly in faraway lands. They have tried multiple locations around the world to recreate the exquisite Hindu Kush vibe, but not always with luck. The most recent is Scott Eastwood's starrer, The Outpost, released last year. It was shot in Bulgaria. The film basks in the false glory of military heroism after Taliban fighters ambush a US military base in remote Afghan province. The incident resulted in multiple disciplinary actions, but the filmmakers will make lions out of lambs.
Now show them some love with the 120s.
You all right, mate? Come on, put your arms around me. You're not gonna die, okay?
RPG! Red platoon!
Peter Berg-directed film The Lone Survivor is perhaps the most high-profile Hollywood film about Afghan war. The movie was released in 2013 and filmed entirely in New Mexico. It tells the story of a lonely survivor in 2015 Operation Red Wings in southern Afghanistan. The movie depicts U.S. soldiers as victims and martyrs in a war they chose and imposed on poor and helpless Afghans.
Going in with a four-man team, Axelson, myself, Dietz, Marcus.
TV. It's a lot more than 10 guys. It's an army.
Brad Pitt's story, War Machine, is a 2017 war satire shot in locations in Germany. It's about a proud military general tasked with winning an unpopular and unwinnable war in which he obviously fails. As a review in Guardian noted, it's not funny enough to be a satire, not realistic enough to count as political commentary, not exciting enough to work as a war movie.
We are here to build, to protect, to support the civilian population. To that end, we must avoid killing it at all costs. We can't help them and kill them at the same time. It just ain't humanly possible.
12 Strong is a 2017 movie shot in New Mexico, which tells the story of first American soldiers to land in Afghanistan in the days after 9/11. It's an unauthentic drama that raises fundamental questions. Why did the U.S. invade Afghanistan and what they have been fighting for over the past 20 years? No answer to that.
Ain't losing one man on this team. The only way home is winning.
Brothers is a 2009 film by Jim Sheridan, filmed again in New Mexico. It follows a U.S. Marine as he tries to reintegrate into normal life after his release as Taliban's prisoner of war. Again, a desperate and often repeated attempt to humanize the war criminals and rationalize the military occupation. Last but not least, Lions for Lambs, featuring Meryl Streep and Tom Cruise, is a high-profile Afghan war film shot in Washington, D.C. and California. It connects a platoon of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, a U.S. senator, a reporter, and a California college professor. Like other filmy projects, this too has an unimpressive plot that seeks to romanticize forces of occupation.
After two decades of military occupation, U.S.-led allied troops are all set to beat a retreat from the South Asian country. The protracted war that commenced after 9/11 attacks, with the U.S. looking for a scapegoat for its own security failure, has been a subject of many war productions, tasked with the painstaking job of justifying the war and making America's illegal military adventures sound legitimate. After the cataclysmic 9/11 events, the advocates of war and foreign military invasions in Washington devised a plan to rope in Hollywood as part of its propaganda for America's so-called war on terror. These films vilified not only the Taliban, but also ordinary Afghans in order to show Americans as good guys. High on propaganda and low on substance, these propagandistic cinematic ventures sought to sell war as something moral and noble by reducing its victims to one-dimensional villains and pushing forward the unexciting story of white saviors. Looking at Hollywood's long archive of war propaganda and its history of acting as agents to post-9/11 U.S. empire, the goal has been to romanticize the diabolical military project in Afghanistan and turn it into a moral imperative in the eyes of American public. But not all endings are happy. This project also failed to produce the desirable results, as is apparent from reams of media coverage about the U.S. defeat and Taliban's resurgence in recent months.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB.